Welcome to Building the Game, a documentary podcast. Today is Monday, February 4th, 2013. This is episode 36 of Building the Game. 36. Man, 36.
It's crazy high number.
It's crazy high. My name is Rob. With me is Jason. What's going on, man?
Just contemplating the meaning of 36 episodes,
36
Rob.
Episodes. Boy, that's a lot, isn't it?
It does seem like...
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Man,
if you
36.
Include bonus episodes, we're in the mid-40s, and
yeah,
it's kind of crazy.
It's crazy. It's wild. Yeah. Boy, when we started this, I was looking forward to it. I thought it would be fun, but, you know, you stop and you think, wow, 36. That's a lot.
I just think that sometimes in episodes, I'm like, what are we talking about? And we've talked about that for 36 episodes.
Wow. Yeah. It's crazy.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. How you doing?
I impressed myself. I'm doing great.
Good.
So the listeners are probably really, really curious about this.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
So I'm just going to spoil it for them.
Okay.
Turns out it took Rob 12 minutes to change the tire. So
you're a liar. You're a liar. You didn't even time me.
I didn't time him. It's true.
You left. I gave you the opportunity, but you left.
Because it's cold.
Yeah.
It was cold then. It's cold now. Ain't going to happen. I don't change my own tires for a reason.
Because you're a girl.
No, because I just don't like to do stuff to cars.
Yeah. Because the
other manly stuff sounds like fun to me. Working on cars.
What manly stuff sounds fun to you? Name one manly thing that you enjoy.
I like camping.
Okay. All right. That's not specifically manly, but
well,
I'll have that.
Hey, to not be sexist, being a mechanic, Rob, is not necessarily a manly thing.
Well, but traditionally speaking, it's a male dominated profession.
That doesn't mean that it's okay to call it manly. We have female listeners that you could have offended.
Well, there are plenty of guys guys who wear makeup, and I don't consider putting on makeup a manly thing. Do you enjoy putting on makeup? Is that one of your manly things you like to do?
No. I think being in the woods, camping, that's manly.
Yeah, all right. No, that's fine. I'll give you that. Do you enjoy woodworking?
No.
Do you enjoy fixing things with your hands?
I enjoy taking things apart.
Do you enjoy lawn maintenance?
I don't enjoy lawn maintenance, but I do a lot of lawn maintenance.
Okay.
If that includes riding my lawnmower around the yard.
All right.
That's it, though.
Uh-huh.
There's other stuff to do, but I don't do it.
Do you like sports cars?
Everybody likes sports cars. You can't say, like, you're not a manly guy, but you can't say you don't like sports cars. If somebody's like, here's a nice sports car. Would you like to drive it? You'd be like, oh, no. No, I'm good. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Anyway. It didn't take me 12 minutes.
And by sports cars, you mean like Mazda Miatas and stuff, right?
Mazda is not really a sports car.
It was a joke. No. I once knew a guy who was like 6'5",
uh-huh.
and he thought he was wicked cool
because
he drove a Miata. It's like, you're not wicked cool.
It's a sports car for girls.
It's certainly not a sports car for 6'5" tall dudes.
Now, RX-8, that's a hot car. But anyway, I'm a big Mazda fan, but you know that.
Yeah. You own a Mazda?
I have a Mazda. I have a Protégé. It's not
well, the
fancy.
Cool thing about Mazda is you can change the tires so fast.
five bolts. Five nuts. That's all it is. Five nuts.
I own a Nissan, and I really like Nissans.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I like Japanese cars in general. It's a little off topic for our podcast about
Welcome back to Car Talk with Rob and Jason.
Building the Car, a documentary podcast.
If I had to build a car, I would fall apart. It'd be Bad News Bears.
Yeah, I wouldn't drive that car. What you been playing?
I've been playing Stone Age.
Oh, yeah? You got it on your iPhone now?
Yeah, I did, which inspired me to play it again with my wife on my own, with just the two of us. And that was a good time. I love Stone Age, right?
Yeah,
the purpose of Stone Age, for anyone who doesn't know, is you're kind of like building your village.
Yeah.
You're not actually playing anything out to do that. It's worker placement. It's mostly just worker placement.
Yep.
It's a great game. And as Rob did mention, yeah, I got it on my iPhone,
mm-hmm.
and it's a phenomenal port.
Yeah.
It works really, really well. The two-player mode on it is just awesome.
Yeah, good.
And the best is, it does all the math for you.
Oh, that's good.
And so, when we play the game, and this is the same way when I played with you, and I know when you played with your wife, once you buy a card
mm-hmm.
Out of like the little boats that come in,
yeah,
you buy the card, it's face down, you don't ever look at it again.
Right.
In the game, you can tell what you have. You don't know what your opponent has, but I can tell I get a plus five for tools. Like I get times five for tools.
It's like it will let you pick that up and look at it anytime you want.
There's just a thing. I click a button and it pops out and it's like it shows the number of tools I have and then it says times and then shows a five there. So I'm like, maybe I should get more tools.
Interesting.
So needless to say, I have not lost a single game against the computer because of that fact.
Because of that right there.
Because it's easy just to go, oh, well, I pay four resources. That's the most expensive, right? Four resources.
Yeah, I think
so. For that one thing. Yeah, because it's three more for the huts, and I have five huts.
Yeah.
Boom, done. You know, so.
Huh, that's a surprise. But, I guess somebody who was not familiar with the board game would, if that was limiting you in the iPhone version, somebody who's not familiar with board game might say, hey, that sucks, why can't I look at all the stuff that I have, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's probably a compromise they made for that. Yeah. Huh. Yeah, I'd like to try that. I had a while ago, Carcassonne, you know, lots of board games, especially major ones, are on iPhone. Carcassonne so far is the only one that I've played that also ended up on Android, and it was super, super broken. Super mega ultra broken.
Oh, that
stinks. Basically unplayable on at least on my phone. So that was a disappointment. And none of the other really good stuff has come over to Android.
Yeah, for my iPhone, I have Settlers of Catan.
Yeah.
I had some weird ripoff version of it.
Oh, yeah.
Called Colonists with a K. And somehow they disabled it for a while and it wouldn't work.
Oh, really?
And they took it off the
copyright
App Store.
Infringement.
Yeah, I mean, it was an obvious, blatant ripoff.
Yeah.
But it was better than the real Catan version, and it was 99 cents compared to $5.
Wow.
So I bought the real Catan version when it was not working.
Yeah.
And the real Catan version is fun, but then one day when I got my new 4S, a year or so ago,
uh-huh,
it started working.
Ooh.
So I've played that on and off. But Stone Age is one of my favorites right now.
Cool.
And it actually inspired me to want to play the real game again. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of the point why those developers do those.
Yeah, and I think I've read that before, that a lot of the big companies are putting their games on iPhone because of that reason, because it drives purchases of the actual board game itself.
We talked to someone at Gen Con, just off the record, I don't remember who it was,
right,
which is good, because, you know, but he had said that when a couple of their games had went onto the iPhone, they saw this hundreds of percent increase in sales of the physical copies of the game.
Yeah. Like, I think I heard that Ticket to Ride was the first one that really hit that. And after that was successful, people were like, oh, let's do this.
Right. And the cool thing is, you're still making money off the app version, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you might take a loss at first because, you know, the cost to program it and such.
Right.
And for all the artwork, I'm sure you have to do different artwork or at least pay to have it ported
modify
over.
Modify all that stuff. Right.
But it really does make sense because you're going to sell copies to people like me of a game like Stone Age because it's Stone Age, and I like the game.
Right.
Now, granted, it's $4.99, which...
That's kind of high for an app.
Yeah. I mean, but because I knew the game, I bought it. Now, I could see that stopping someone who's not used to, you know what I mean? Like, if I just say, hey, Stone Age is a fun game, and you don't know what it is, you might be like, gosh, $5? Man, I bought 99 cents.
Stone Age is a great game, and $5 to play Stone Age, that's cheap. It's cheap.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially because, honestly... Like I said, there are some things that I like better about that version than the real version.
Right.
Yeah. How about you, sir?
You know, not a whole lot. I've been working a lot on Splitters, though. I'm still playing Mirror's Edge on my PS3, and I think I'm almost done with that. But I've been working a lot on Splitters. Got some good feedback from some playtests from some other people, so... I've taken a couple more steps. I've added names to all the cards.
Nice.
And I filled it out. It was 22 cards, and every card was in there at least twice. Some of them more than that. So I stretched it up to a total of 25 cards in the 25 unique cards. Each one is in the deck twice. Added names, and I've added the materials frames to it. And I'm finishing up my work on getting the next print and play set of that ready, so I can start printing out and trying those new cards, trying the new materials bonuses, that kind of stuff. So That's been a lot of fun.
Sweet. I look forward to trying that with you again. Yeah. That was fun the first time.
Yeah.
As the listeners heard.
Yeah. And it's fun to, to put that together, and it's coming together real quick too. Every time I do a revision, it's been easy to take the next step to get it revised. I mean, I had to redo all the artwork, because one of the fundamental things is I flipped the, basically mirrored the arrangement of the information on the card.
Right.
So I had to redo all of my templates and everything from the beginning, but you know, whatever, it's still, they're just real basic templates I did in Photoshop. So it was pretty simple, pretty quick.
So says you. Oh, it's super simple.
Well, all things considered, they're pretty
basic. I just
sit in
front of Photoshop and swear a lot.
Yeah.
True story.
Yeah. But yeah, that's about it. You know, nothing special for me. I've been working too much lately. Too much work. Too much real work, not fun work.
Day jobs.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, dude, seriously. Yeah. What are you looking at?
Your pirate ship in a bottle over there.
Oh.
It's actually a pirate ship in a box.
Well, it's
still unassembled.
It's still unassembled. It's paper craft, and it's a pirate ship set where you may build a paper craft pirate ship in an actual glass bottle. It was a Christmas present, I think, 3 years ago from somebody.
Oh, cool.
And I just kind of don't have the heart to throw it away.
Hope they're not listening to the show, because they are sad now. What's the, while we're talking about things that are in Rob's studio here.
Yeah.
What is the machine gun with the, red tip on the end?
That's an M16 airsoft rifle.
Does that shoot like the...
Yeah, plastic little pellets.
So what do you use that for?
That was for my Rambo costume.
Oh,
for Halloween a couple years ago. The same the camouflage pants that I was wearing last week. I bought those for that same costume. Yeah. And it actually it's a pretty convincing M16. I mean, it looks good.
Except for the red tip.
Yeah, well, except for the red tip. It's a little small, you know, it's
right.
It's probably about, you know, 70% actual size. But it's cool. And it shoots. You know, you pull the hammer back, you pull a trigger, and it goes pop. I've never actually shot any of the little pellets, though, because I'm afraid of, you know, hurting somebody. And they're just little plastic pellets, and they don't go very far, I don't think, but still. I don't want to get in the habit of shooting at things.
Good plan.
Yeah, because it'd be too tempting to shoot the cat, you know? Yeah. I don't want to do that.
The cat's nice. I would feel bad about
that. I would feel bad about that, too.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that was a nice off-topic thing. Hey, how about a mechanic we could talk about?
Okay. You want to do that?
Yeah, you got one of those?
I got one of those. I thought I would talk about grid movement, like and that could be a square grid, or that could be a hex grid, but just that idea of moving a pawn on a grid. The simplest basic example of this is chess or checkers.
Checkers is probably the simplest.
Yeah. Chess is a step up from that. You're right. But yeah, I mean, it just this is kind of one of the most fundamental mechanics in gaming, period. So many things used grids to move pieces around. And, you know, and I thought it would be worthwhile to talk about that. And we've both had game designs we've talked about where we've wanted to use a grid for movement. It just seems like such a basic thing, you know?
Yep. Spoiler alert. I actually have one today that uses movement.
There you go.
I mean, it's not the main thing, but so moving things, I mean, the grid-based movement, especially if you're including like hexes and squares.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, that's every war game ever made, pretty much.
Basically, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Not every, but a majority of them involve that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, there's a difference between grid movement and other things like area movement, you know?
Right.
And we looked at this just to make sure that we were kind of together on our understanding and how to define this. So grid movement is your movement of your units, of your pawns, is within a defined, consistent shape grid. Okay. All the squares are the same size. All the hexes are the same size, right? Area movement would be irregular shaped things.
Risk.
Like Small World. Mansions of Madness has that same idea too. The rooms of the mansions have areas that are kind of oddly shaped, defined for moving pieces around. So area movement is moving pieces from variated shaped sections of a board to others, whereas grid is a defined set distances and shapes and that kind of stuff.
I'm curious, a game like Clue, would mm-hmm. that be considered both? The reason I say that is because you right, it's obviously it's grid movement.
When
right?
you're in the hallways, it's grid.
But once
yeah.
you're in the rooms, you can actually some of the rooms can passageway you to other rooms, which I would argue is area movement.
That would be more point to point movement, wouldn't it?
Well, some would say that point to point movement is basically just area movement.
We read BGG.
That actually wasn't planned right there. No, but right. Anyways,
no, you're right. You're right. Yeah, that I could buy that.
It's
yeah.
kind of a mixture of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So I just. Thought of that when we were talking. So, yeah. grid movement, bonuses to grid movement, like reasons why I think grid movement is cool.
Yeah.
Is, you know, it allows you to lay out a pretty dense board in some cases.
It can, sure.
With a lot of movement.
Yeah.
A game like Risk, pretty dense. I mean, there's a lot of movement, but certainly not as much as mm-hmm. there would be if Risk was just a bunch of hexes.
Yeah.
Now, granted, a game like Risk would probably be terrible if that were the case.
I think so.
Because you'd be moving your armies. It would take mm-hmm. forever.
Yeah, but Risk is not necessarily about moving from point A to point B. It's about capturing large areas, you know?
I mean, Risk is, I mean,
it's also a different style of game.
Area
yeah.
control.
Right.
I mean, yeah. It's not just area movement.
Yeah.
The idea is to control said areas.
Right. So, using that grid movement, it forces some tactical strategy. And careful choice, decision making about how your units are going to move and direction and all that kind of stuff, can kind of help you control the flow of a game from the designer's point of view.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah,
especially if you give people certain starting areas.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought of that would be kind of interesting. Was I was thinking of grid control. So like, you're trying to control like little grids. Picture like a game where you like have water movement. Water flow, trying to fill in. Maybe you can color the squares as you go, like on the rail games where you color with crayons.
Yeah,
yeah, that's fun.
Catan has grid based movement, doesn't it?
No, Catan no? doesn't actually. Well,
because you're building roads along the edges of those hexes, right?
So, yes and no.
Okay.
You build the roads to get places, but it's not like you move through those. It's just those are opening your options.
Oh,
you
okay.
can't build somewhere until the road touches it.
I've got to play Catan.
I was just thinking, 36 episodes in, Rob still never played Catan.
No Catan. I got to do that, man. I got to get that. Okay. So, why would we choose another form of movement over grid-based movement?
Well, I think we just said that, I mean, area movement works mm-hmm. great for Risk, and grid movement would suck for it. So
if we're talking about trying to conquer territories, generally the area movement stuff would probably be a little better, more appropriate. But if we're trying to get from point A to point B, the grid movement makes more sense.
Yeah, I think, I mean, grid movement is more about point A to point B, getting yeah. from one place to another.
Yeah.
Area movement is about that, but less so. I think. I mean,
less so. Yeah, I think you're right. It's more about area control.
In the games I think of that involve grid movements,
mm-hmm.
you're going places.
Yeah.
The goal is to get to different places and do stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting because Mansions of Madness has irregularly shaped areas that you move between, and a major part of that game is moving from point to point to get stuff.
So are there no grid tiles in those?
There's no grid. I mean, there are tiles, but they're divided up into unevenly shaped sections of movement. And it's kind of weird.
It's possible, though, that they were thinking that if you take Mansions of Madness and turn it into a game like Clue,
mm-hmm.
and now you're walking everywhere all the time, that yeah. would be boring.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So, okay. So then you also need to think a lot about the size or the scale of your grid when you're designing that, you know?
Right, and the amount of movement available to you.
Right, right. That can be a key thing on balancing your game. The distance between points, basically, and how long it takes you to get between those points. And, you know, the bigger scale your grid, the shorter the distance between places. So then you'd kind of have to say the, you know, the shorter distance your pieces would be able to move on that grid.
So I think obviously one of the cons, you know, so some of the pros are help you get around. I mean, obviously with design, like you said, we've got to think about how far can I move on a turn?
Yeah.
And is movement the only point? Obviously there's roll and move that involves grid movement, which is terrible. I mean, not always terrible, but roll and move standardly.
Yeah.
Not awesome.
Sure.
Now as a con, you could spend the whole game running around, even on a non-roll and move game, if it was designed poorly for the distances, right? I mean, yeah, you could just spend the whole game running between rooms. I mean, Clue has that issue. Clue is, of course, a roll and move game, but, you know, there are times in Clue where you're just like, wow,
I'm stuck wandering these hallways trying to get to where I need to go. Right. Meanwhile, everybody else is getting stuff done.
Go to the billiard room!
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a potential danger for you.
Okay, so I think we agree that positives are, well, it can kind of split up the board, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it can make movement a part of the game. I guess you have to design with the idea in mind that movement is good to be part of the game, right?
Yeah.
If you want it to be a challenge to get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just, let's just slide into the next room via the area movement.
Yeah. You also, though, you don't want the distance, the traveling that grid to feel like a slog. You know, you don't want that to get in the way of the fun, which kind of is part of the downside of Clue, honestly, is that you can only get stuff done in Clue when you're in a room.
Right.
And getting out of one room into another one is kind of, it's the downtime. It's the time when you're like, man, I just gotta get there. Would Clue benefit from eliminating that roll and move idea and just give you a set number of movement points?
There's actually a version of Clue. I don't remember what it's called, but Chris from Flip the Table was talking to me about it one day. Uh-huh. And it's an action point system. They've basically taken over the dice, made it an action point system. So many points to move, so many points to guess, and such.
Okay.
And I guess it's supposed to be really cool.
Yeah.
I would love to see the rules on that and give it a try.
Yeah, for sure.
Because then, you know, there's a lot more strategy involved in it. You know, the thing about Clue, the reason the roll and move stinks so much is because Clue is a game that really rewards people for good deduction skills.
Yeah.
And for really paying attention.
Yeah.
So it stinks to be penalized by roll and
move. By a crappy die roll, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a brilliant deduction game, and then they tacked on roll and move.
It's really crippled by that, yeah.
It really is.
And I've said many times before that I really, really like Clue a lot.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So the cons, the idea that it's like, I mean, I know what you're talking about. Clue is a good example, but there are other games where you're like, okay, I'm here. I need to get way to the other side of the board.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be like a 5-turn investment, and I'm going to get nothing done in between there.
Yeah.
And that's not fun.
No.
That's not fun at all. So you really think I need to balance to at least, if it's going to be far, make people move faster, right?
Yeah.
You know, or make it so that people can do things along the way. A game that could get away with this possibly would be some sort of pickup and delivery game where mm-hmm. you are going from one side of the board to the other to do deliveries and such, right?
Mm-hmm.
To pick up on one side, deliver on the other. That kind of gets a pass, right? Because the purpose of the game...
The game is about moving.
It's about traveling, yeah. Because you're picking up and delivering.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a game where I think area movement would not work
as well. Yeah, you're right.
Because it would be too easy to be moving through areas faster than if you were, you know, having to follow a grid that would take you farther out and back and such.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we like grid movement. We like it. We understand its positives and negatives, which is kind of the important thing here. Man, I really want to design a roll and move game that doesn't suck.
Yes.
I really want to do that.
Yeah, it's tempting because, you know, I mean, we both listen to the Flip the Table podcast.
Yeah.
And most of the games they play are roll and move games.
Yeah.
Because that was just, you know, the era that they're playing in and the type of game they're playing in.
Yeah.
That's just what you did. You made roll and move games, you know? And the idea that so many of those games the big flaw is their rolling move. They could be semi-valid games,
right?
Except for the rolling move.
Yeah.
That's got to be frustrating for them. You know what I mean? To be playing a game where they're like, it would have been so easy to make this not terrible by not making it rolling move.
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. So I really want to do that. I want to work on that. I want to work on something, you know, a grid-based movement. All right. You know, and maybe just have a big wide open space and you're rolling to move your piece. And based on where you end up, you can take certain actions. But something where that roll is, regardless of the result, the roll can be rewarding, you know?
Yeah. I mean, one of the big, you know, the biggest sins they talk about with roll and move is roll and move exact count.
Yeah.
Which, you know, would mean include to walk into a room. You have to hit the exact count to get in, which you don't. But if you did, how terrible would that be?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's actually, that's one of the great things about Clue is that you just have to get in the door.
Right.
It makes that game manageable, frankly. And if you had to get exact count to that door, the game would be unplayable.
Well, the nice thing, the argument I make for Clue that you might be able to get away with that is, the way the board's set up, because the hallways are wide, you might be able to do circles and stuff.
Yeah, you don't want to have to do that,
but
though.
But you don't want to have to do that. But that would make the game take a lot longer, that's
for
sure.
A lot longer.
It would
terrible.
Be a waste. And you'd just be annoyed at the people that didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't make it.
Well, moving on. We knocked that around enough, I think. Grid-based movement, understanding good and bad, and how it's different from other movement ideas.
Okay. I concur.
I think you have a game to pitch now, don't you?
I do.
Why don't you practice that pitch?
Oh, let's do that, shall we?
Yeah. Talk to me.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about this game before I pitch it, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I just want to kind of go through the process here, because we've talked a lot about kind of our different process for coming up with pitches.
Yeah.
And I'm very big on coming up with theme first, before mechanics.
Yeah.
And then trying to not tack mechanics on, but build mechanics that make that game feel good with the theme, you know, then kind of make it feel cohesive with the theme.
Right.
So to that end, I was trying to think of a game idea, and I was trying to think of something kind of unique and different. And I was flipping through some stuff, and something that kind of popped in my head that might be fun to design would be a noir game, like a noir detective game, right?
Okay.
And so I looked up some detective games like 221 B Baker Street and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And those are deduction games. They involve storytelling, role-playing, deduction. I didn't want to make those games. I wanted to make a game where you were solving cases, but there was no deduction involved, right?
Oh, okay.
Solving cases really involved kind of like set collection,
okay.
Right?
Okay, yeah,
so
yeah,
like,
yeah.
To solve this case, you need 5 pieces of evidence, right? And those pieces of evidence are red, blue, green, yellow. Each of those things have a set meaning, right?
Sure.
Like red is like, I don't know. You get what I mean, right?
Blood evidence.
Right. So there's different types of evidence you need to get.
Sure.
You can only get those types of evidence in certain places. So you're almost like building a recipe to solve a case.
Okay.
Right? So I thought that's kind of sounded like a cool idea. And this is one of those games where you and I haven't talked about it much at all. I kind of told you about the idea. So
I came up. Yeah.
Yeah. And you said, don't tell me anymore about it.
Do it on the podcast.
So,
yeah.
Which is always a good sign to me because it means that Rob's interested in the pitch rather than he's just like, all right, tell me about it. Oh, this sucks. I'll pretend to like it on the show. He doesn't do that. Well, I hope he doesn't, but he might. So in this case, this game, I came up with the idea for it. And the first thing I came up with after that was the name, which Rob is gaga for.
It's a great name.
The
it
name
really is.
Is to fit that kind of 1940s noir, is In a Hail of Bullets. And
yeah, that to me, that's the title for a pulp novel right there.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
I can see that, yeah. So obviously that's a popular term. Like, I've heard that term used many times referring to pulp things, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I thought, I want to tie in with that. So I started working backwards from what are things that have to be included in those noir things. You know, you have to be playing a PI, right? You have to have case. You have to have a secretary, right? Because they always have the awesome secretary with different skills and stuff.
Yeah.
You have to have a dame who's always getting in the way. You have to have a nemesis.
Yeah.
You know, these are the things. There has to be the one bar that you can't go to as your character. So these are all the things that are kind of swimming in my head. So now let's talk a little more about the game. So the primary mechanic of the game, so there's a board, right? It's a board game. There's a board. It involves grid movement to go from location to location. The board is set up with different locations.
Okay.
You know, bars, a hospital, a police station, different PI offices, because each person has their own kind of home base.
Yeah, sure, that makes sense.
Because that's always kind of plays into those movies. You have to have your own office, right?
Yeah.
You know, back alleys, the docks, warehouses, all these different fun locations that you would see in these movies.
Traditional stuff.
Exactly. And I want to have a lot of those, you know, and each one have different symbols on it that'll tell you the type of evidence you could get there to solve your case and such. So I thought, well, I want to have that, but I was trying to think of a way to handle everything in one. I was trying to kind of think of like how Rob likes to design, which is a lot more simplistic than the way I like to design. And I mean that in a good way. You know, you want to have one deck of cards. You don't want to have five decks like I want to have, and you don't want to have any dice. You want to have... Let that deck do everything for it. And I thought, well, the easiest way to do that would be to make it a deck building game.
Okay.
And I was like, a noir deck building game that's a board game. I'm like, that sounds cool to me. I like that. Because it's a little different. So so the primary mechanics are deck building, grid movement, set collection, action points, which figure into doing things. That's to let you know how many cards you can play and such. And then variable player powers as well. Which goes with your private eye and also with your people that you have in your deck. Okay. So the goal of the game is to solve a certain number of cases. Right now I'm thinking probably five cases. So each case has a set number of things you need to get to solve it, like I said.
Okay.
And in the meantime, to do that, you're trying to build your deck. Now, should be said, for deck building games, right? There's a standard. That standard is Dominion.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're going to make a deck building game, you're challenged, I feel at least, being a huge fan of Dominion, and other people have agreed with us on this, you're challenged to the Dominion standard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Make it as simple and fun as Dominion, but don't make it be Dominion.
Yeah.
You have to find a way to make it not be a carbon copy.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things that I liked about the board, is it automatically sets it apart from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're trying to move around a board and do things.
Mm-hmm.
Totally not what Dominion's about. But still, I feel like there need to be additional tweaks to make it not be just like Dominion.
Okay.
And maybe that's just a complex I have of being concerned about that.
No. I'm with you, though. You don't want to just reskin a game that somebody else made.
Right. Because, I mean, what's the point, right?
Right.
I mean, unless you can publish it through them and make a ton of money, I don't know what the point is.
Right.
And even then, it would feel kind of sad. I mean, maybe you can make an expansion set for Dominion Noir.
No.
Call me Donald X Vecarino. I've got a plan here. Dominion Noir. Okay. So you get a... stop me if at any point I confuse you. But so what happens at the beginning of the game, each person is dealt a tableau, which on the tableau, for anybody who doesn't know what that is, it's like a small board, basically, that's in front of you. You get this tableau. Stone Age uses it. AJ's Hostage Negotiator game actually uses the tableau really well, which was kind of inspiring for me for this, seeing a tableau work so well and serve so many purposes in one small compact thing that I thought this is kind of cool. So the tableau has your private investigator on it, and it tracks a bunch of different things on there. I mean, it's kind of like your character sheet, right?
Mm-hmm.
It tracks the evidence that you need to... it doesn't track that. It's like the one thing it doesn't track. Sorry. But it tracks a lot of different things that you need. It tracks what your powers are. And there would be six different ones. The idea is it's a four-player game. Theoretically, a 2-4-player game, because you got to figure out how to balance that for both.
Yeah.
But there would be six tableaus, so they'd be shuffled upside down, passed out. So not every PI is always going to be used. The tableau is going to tell you some things. For instance, where your office is, right? Because every PI has a different office on the board. That allows them to kind of like have a home base.
Okay.
Your tableau also has things like your hit points, your ammo, and all the other things you would track throughout the game.
Okay.
So you've got your tableau, and then everyone's going to get a starting deck of cards.
Okay.
Like in Dominion, right? Where everybody has a starting deck. So your starting deck is going to consist of a dame. Which everyone's going to get a different dame. I think there'll probably be about six dames in the deck as well.
Is the dame automatically tied to a specific detective, or that's random?
Nope, it's random.
Okay.
A dame, a secretary, also random. A couple of allies, who are people who owe you favors, which are dealt out at random from the main deck.
Okay.
You know, they'd be sorted out. A couple of move cards that allow you to move so many spaces on the board. some money cards that aren't worth much, like $10 a piece, because you have to buy evidence sometimes from people and buy favors.
Got it.
A favor card, which is a card that says that someone owes you a favor. Mm-hmm. You can call upon that when you have it. A debt card, which works the opposite, kind of can screw you when you pull it out.
Okay.
It allows your opponent to play a favor on you if you have your debt card out.
All
right. And a couple of ammo cards. Now, one of the things that I wanted to do differently with this game was I thought it would be cool if you, when you got your cards, some of your cards you have to use, you have to deal with when they come up. For instance, your Dame card.
Mm-hmm.
Really, in trying to keep with the theme of Noir and the Noir Detective, the Dame is always causing problems, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
So when that Dame card comes up, you can't just ignore it. You have to deal with it. Now, what's cool is the Dame has a special ability. And if you save her, so you pick up the Dame card, you've got it, oh, crap. You lay it down, and it says she's in some sort of trouble. It would be the type of, you know, like, this is her location or whatever, and it would say on the card, but it would be randomized as to what was actually what you needed to do. But so you'd spend your action points to do what you needed to do to play cards to save her.
Okay.
And now she's got an unlockable ability you can use, which might help you get evidence or grant you a favor towards someone else.
Okay.
So there is a bonus to it.
Okay.
But it can be a hindrance when you draw that card with a perfect combination of cards that allow you to do something else that you need to do.
Mm.
Because remember, you're trying to drive around town, which means your move cards become very important.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought would be neat would be the idea of throwaway cards. So, for instance, your ammo cards. You start with two ammo cards. And anytime you get in a gunfight, which is going to happen a lot during the game, because
okay.
people want to shoot at you.
Yeah. All right.
Because people don't like you. Hence, in a hail of bullets.
Yeah.
When you draw an ammo card, you can use it or you can put it back in your discard pile. If you put it in your discard pile, it's going to eventually get cycled back into your hand,
okay.
and you're going to be able to use it again. But when you're like, oh, I'm out of ammo, you have to play it. You play it, it goes back in the ammo stack. You've lost it.
Mm.
So you would need to purchase ammo again later in the game. Does that make sense?
So it's not that you have to play that card in order to have ammo when you're in a gunfight. You always have a set number of amount of ammo.
Tracked on your tableau.
Tracked on your tableau, and then you get in a gunfight. And if you run out of ammo, you have to play another ammo card in order to refill your gun.
Right. And if you got in a gunfight before that, ruh-roh, Scooby.
You better run.
You can't fight back.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So I thought that was kind of cool. And then the last thing that I thought would be kind of neat was the idea of the sleeve card or having a card up your sleeve, right? Or, you know, kind of like the poker game idea, right?
Sure.
So when you get a card, and you get your five cards or whatever you draw, you can look at one and say, I'd rather have that next turn. I'm going to sleeve it.
Hmm.
So everybody gets to see what it is, but you drop it down, and now it's your sleeve card. So next turn, you could pull it out.
Oh.
You can only keep it for one turn, that you have to use it the next turn or discard it, right? And then you can put another card there.
Okay.
But what it allows you to do is, I was thinking about doing it, like how many times you're like, gosh, I got a three gold card this turn and no other money.
Yeah.
What a pain in the butt. You know, I really wish I could buy something here.
Right.
Why don't I save it for next turn?
Yeah. Okay.
So it kind of allows you to manage your turns.
Yeah.
Now, evidence cards work the same way. So when you go to a place and you collect an evidence card, which involves going to different bars and such, you get your evidence card. So I've got my blue piece of evidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
You put that in your deck. Well, it goes in your discard pile. Sorry. When it's shuffled back into your deck, you get to play that evidence card. So you're going to collect the evidence, but you can't use it right away. So if you're close to winning the game or close to finishing a case,
mm-hmm.
now your opponents know. There's like a countdown, right? Okay, well, Rob's got the card. It's in his discard pile. So once that's shuffled back into your deck, right? So mm-hmm. that's going to give them a chance to scry and screw with you by maybe playing cards that make you discard out of your discard, like, you know, to throw it out completely.
Okay.
I also like the idea that when you're traveling around, things like ammo and stuff like that can only be purchased at certain places. So when you're purchasing these different cards, right,
mm-hmm.
which you do with money, you know, the whole system is based with the money. You know, there's money cards, just like there would be in a Dominion. You start with really cheap ones,
mm-hmm.
and then you can buy more expensive as you go.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm trying to imagine, and you might not have gotten to this yet, but I'm trying to imagine the flow of a turn, and it seems like the first thing that you would do is you would play whatever cards you can to take whatever actions you can, and then you take cards to build your deck, I'm just trying to imagine how you're gaining more cards. You say you have to move to a specific location to get a certain kind of card, and then you spend money to get that.
Right.
So,
I think some cards you should be able to buy anywhere. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's too limiting to say you have to go to the weapon shop if you want to buy some ammo, right? Maybe that's a bad idea. The evidence-based cards, definitely. You have to go to specific locations to get a hold of
them. To gather that evidence,
right,
yeah.
And you're paying people off. My idea would be that every time you go to a new location, you've got this, you've got different people that can be played out in those locations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I could use a little bit of help here. My thought would be that, my initial thought was that maybe I have cards, right? Like, so I've got Frankie the Fish, right? And he is at this jupe joint or something, whatever.
Yeah.
So I go there, because that's where it says he would be, right? So I go there, and once I go there, I can play that card. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. You can only play that if that came up in your hand on this turn.
Right. So see, that's why it can be a little limiting. Yeah. Now, granted, you could sleeve that card, right?
Yeah. See, what I'm worried about, though, is that every time I draw my hand up from my turn, I have five cards here, and I say, oh, I want to go to the speakeasy to use my Frankie the Fish card. I don't have it, and so I need to drive there. I need to drive four spaces to get there. I'm worried that, okay, I'm going to sleeve that and I'm going to go there, but I'm not going to have enough movement points to get there on this turn. And so I'm going to sleeve that and hope that I get enough movement points in the next turn. And then I don't. I have enough movement points maybe to get almost there, but not enough. I already sleeved Frankie, and I have to get rid of him on this turn, so I have to throw him away. And now, well, the whole point of me going to the speakeasy to see Frankie the Fish is gone because I don't have the Frankie card anymore.
Okay.
This is kind of the worry that I have, is that I want to make sure that I'm going to be able to do something on every turn, that I'm not just always on my way to get somewhere, and then just as I'm about to get there, my whole chance to do anything there is gone. That's what I'm worried about.
Okay.
And I don't want to have to just count on, I'm going to hang out at this place in hopes that I get one of these cards up in my deck.
Right. So here was another couple ways I had to thought of deal with it, right? So that's one way, right? So you could have, he could be an ally card, right? So you've got him and you know he's going to be your pal if you can play him when you're in that location.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a range of locations. Maybe it's, he could be in one of these three places. That might make it a little easier if it wasn't just he's always in this one bar. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What you might do is you might have a spot on your tableau for your active informant or your active person of interest. All right.
Okay.
And so you can play your Frankie the Fish card on your tableau in there. You can install him there. And so my number one goal is I got to work toward getting to Frankie to help him so he can help me with piece of evidence until my Dame card comes up. And then my Dame card goes on top of Frankie. And I got to go deal with my Dame so I can make her card to go away. And then I can get back to Frankie. And so you can be stacking these character cards up on your tableau.
Okay.
Sometimes a character would go on top of another one. Sometimes the card would require me to throw away the old person of interest and put the new one down, depending on various powers of each of those characters.
Right.
And so that number one goal, that's there. And so I'm working towards that unless something else gets in the way. But, you know, with the Dame, I have to put the Dame on top. But other guys, I have the choice of putting one of them on top of Frankie.
So, see, I like that. So you could have a case, right? You get your new case. Because the cases would be a separate deck. And they have to be.
Sure.
You draw a case. You lay it down. So now you've got your case. You're going to look for your main informant. You're going to pick them up and set them down as well. Which...
You might want to consider just having everybody draw one case for the whole game. The first person to solve their case is the winner. Because then you can make the cases really long.
And that was another thought I had was, you know, the case requires five types of each evidence or something like that, you know, to where, and the cases that obviously all be slightly different, where they would require different bunches of evidence, but try and make it equally difficult. Mm-hmm. So if that were the case, then you would draw informants out of your, so another way I thought to handle it would be you've got, you know, like in Dominion, your stack of cards, right?
Mm-hmm.
All the same, right? Mm-hmm. A cellar is a stack of cellars. Town is a stack of towns. But what if there was a stack of informants?
And every single one was different.
Yeah, so there's a stack of blue informants, a stack of red informants, and you can see who's on top.
Yeah.
Okay? So I know that when I go to this place, I'm going to be able to take that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be my informant now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could drop him down. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And then after, once he's in the discard pile, he's out of the game after, or should I keep getting him back? I mean, I guess if he's my informant for now and then I pitch him.
I think if you put him in on your person of interest spot on the tableau and you make it to him and you deal with him, then he goes in the trash. But if you mean
not your discard.
Right. I mean, trash.
He's out of the game.
Out of the game. Right. Okay. But if you put your dame on top of that, or if you say, nah, I'm not going to talk to him yet, and you swap him for a different person of interest, then if you don't deal with him, he would go back to your discard so he can come back up later. I think that's would be the better way to handle that.
So what you could do is you could have cards like heat cards, right? That was like, I'm not to use that term from, I know that's how you do it in that, what's that game?
Banditos.
But yeah. You know, like basically like I could put a hit out on that guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now he's got to go into hiding. So he's got to come off my person of interest and mm-hmm. go into my discard.
Yeah.
And now I got to get back to him.
Yeah.
Another idea I had would be the idea that people could play cards against you. So like I go to this jupe joint and I've got a nemesis on my tableau that says like, oh. These are people that hate this PI.
Yeah.
Because okay. You have to have a nemesis if you're, sure, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So if I can get a hold of that nemesis, you know what I mean? Meaning if that nemesis comes up and some other player can buy him,
yeah.
Now they can give him to me.
Mm-hmm.
So they could play him out when I went to one of those places.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So I guess one thought, you know, I had originally thought that each person had a favored location, right? So like Frankie the Fish, his favorite location is this restaurant or this bar, this speakeasy, whatever. I know that was the 20s, but you know what I mean?
So
that's his favored location. So when he's in play on my tableau, he's at that location.
Okay.
So yeah. People could go there, hit him, do whatever they needed to do, right? Mm-hmm. Because I like the idea of you kind of screwing each other over.
Yeah, somebody could walk in there and shoot him down.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that, you know, whenever you went into a location, any bar or anything, there's a chance that a gunfight could break out because of, you know, you causing a fight or something like that. You know,
yeah.
Noir style. And in addition, there would be a couple locations for you that, like, you're not welcome. So depending on mm-hmm. the case you draw...
Yeah.
And the type of the stuff you need and the locations you're not welcome, that could be very difficult for you.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, kind of like each location kind of has its own feelings about you. And so there's more likely that you could be ambushed in certain locations and stuff like that.
Sure.
Because I really want to feel that, you know, like noir detective, shoot 'em up type thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay.
So yeah, that's I mean, that's primarily the game.
Okay.
Obviously, it's got some more thinking to do with it. I've been working on it for about a week now, just getting all this stuff together.
Yeah.
One of the cards, the secretary card that you'd have in your deck, that you use a given at the beginning.
Yeah.
Each secretary would have a different thing they're good at, so okay. You could send them to do things. So maybe there's a place you can't go, and the one secretary, she comes heavy, right? So she's she can go in for you,
okay.
You know, to try and get the information at that one place.
Yeah.
Only when she comes up, you know okay. What I mean? So,
yeah, that's cool. That's there's a lot of details to work out.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but I would like to play that.
Yeah. No, this is a game that I know I've said this before, but I you and I have been talking. And I think it's okay to tell everybody this. We've been talking about wanting to do the, possibly for Gen Con, to do the playtest area where we would actually...
first exposure.
Yeah, buy a table. Each of us would.
Yeah.
Buy a slot to show our thing.
Right.
So really the pressure is kind of on for us for determining what game we want to do that with.
Yeah. And I think we each kind of want to have two games.
Yeah. I mean...
ready to go.
If possible, definitely. Kind of our primary and then kind of another one we can test out too.
Right.
I really feel like this is a different enough idea that it could really benefit from something like that, getting mm-hmm. a lot of players I don't know coming in and playing it.
Yeah.
So I think this is, because I know I have time for this, I think this is one of the ones I'd like to try it with.
Okay.
And I think it would be well received thematically wise.
I think so.
That's important too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah, so that's my pitch.
Okay. I like it.
I if I can get a prototype together, I certainly will play it on the show and we will record it and all that jazz.
Yeah.
So,
well, thank you for pitching in a hail of bullets. It's the greatest name either one of us has ever come up with for a game. And I just love Thanks. That. Yeah. We had toyed before, with the idea of challenging each other to pitch something based on some criteria that we give each other.
Yes.
And I think we're going to try and do that now. The next episode that I'm going to pitch a game, I think you're going to give me a challenge here.
Yes. I'm going to give you a title of a game. And I'm thinking I will give you a mechanic,
a title and a core mechanic. Okay.
And
then I have to pitch a game to go with that.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
In fact, let's do this. Okay. I'm going to give you two core mechanics.
Ooh, I have to merge.
Yeah, have to merge. Because that makes it a little more challenging. Because if I give you a name and a mechanic, that's pretty easy. So let me give you a name and two core mechanics.
Okay.
Because I'm debating between which two anyways.
Okay.
So,
we can do that. All right. And then next time, after I pitch this one, it'll be my turn to challenge you.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So now I'm not trying to be a jerk. I'm actually trying to be nice.
Okay.
The when I think of this game, this sounds like something that's pretty centered in your wheelhouse.
Okay.
So, at least the style of games you like to pitch.
Okay.
A little fun, you know, sometimes a little silly with the theme, but it works. So the name of the game is Hibachi Master.
Okay. Hibachi Master.
I picture this game having something to do with using hibachi.
Okay.
So the main mechanics, work placement, something you're a fan of.
Okay.
The second one, area control.
Ooh.
So, Hibachi Master, you must use worker placement and area control.
Hibachi Master with worker placement and area control.
Yeah, so...
All right.
So, we'll see what you do with that. So, it's funny because, I mean, I kind of have some expectations in my head as to what I would do. So, it's really interesting to hear what you're going to do with it.
Okay.
And I'm equally excited to hear what you'll send back to me. For my next match.
Yeah, I'm going to give that some thought. All right. Hibachi Master with worker placement and area control. Okay. All right. We'll see what I can come up with then. So listeners, stay tuned. The next episode where with me pitching a game, I will be pitching the exciting new board game, Hibachi Master.
It's going to be a good time. Yeah,
this is really dumb. All right. This will be fun. Okay, cool.
All right. I don't have anything else today.
Me too. All right. We're all clear then. Thank you, everybody, again, for listening to the show. Keep on coming back every week as we keep on doing more of this really dumb, silly stuff, like pitching games called Hibachi Master. I'm a little lost. I'm kind of reeling from that.
I'm sorry. I thought it was a good day.
No, it's good. It's good. All right. That'll be a challenge. Okay. You can check out our website, which is buildingthegamepodcast.com, and you can send us an email to buildingthegamepodcast@gmail.com. Please do that. We like emails. The more, the better. Please, please. You can follow us on Twitter, @podcastbtg. Jason is @JASlingerland, and I am @poorly_designed. You can like us on Facebook. That'd be cool. Remember, the challenge is still out there. If we can get to 100 likes on Facebook, then Jason will do something fabulous for us.
I will. It's going to be blow your mind.
I cannot wait to see what that is. But we need you listeners, you out there, to get us 100 likes. You can also give us a 5-star review on iTunes. That'd be awesome. Tell you what, if you leave us a 5-star review and make comments on there, we'll read those on the show. Guaranteed, we will.
We will.
I promise.
Even if the comments are negative, as long as you give us the 5 stars.
As long as you give us the 5 stars, right? Yeah, and you can keep on coming back over and over and over again. 36 episodes down, 37 coming next week. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.
All the ideas presented by Rob and Jason are the property of the Building the Game podcast.
Next time on Building the Game...